This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Today is a somber anniversary, the first anniversary since the city of Philadelphia recognized its leaders' roles in the horrific act of setting fire to a city block in a predominantly black neighborhood in 1985, and the first since an equally gruesome discovery about one of the people who did not survive. On May 13, 1985, six adults and five children were killed in an event known as the MOVE bombing. MOVE was a political and religious organization made up of men, women, and children. Their lifestyle choices were unusual and their positions radical to some. They all went by the same last name, Africa. They were animal rights activists. They moved into a middle-class black neighborhood on Osage Avenue and were disruptive, according to neighbors who complained about trash and the use of a bullhorn at odd hours and erratic behaviors. Police had a warrant for the arrest of some of the MOVE members on charges like illegal firearms and parole violations. What began with an order by the city's mayor to evict MOVE from a row house turned into a standoff between hundreds of Philadelphia police officers versus the MOVE members. After the water cannons and the tear gas, the mayor approved orders to drop a satchel bomb on the roof of the house where the MOVE members and their children were sheltered. The bomb led to a fire that firefighters were told to let burn by the police commissioner. It destroyed 61 houses and killed Netta Africa, Tree Africa, Phil Africa, Delicia Africa, Tommaso Africa, John Africa, Conrad Africa, Raymond Africa, Frank Africa, Rhonda Africa, and Teresa Africa. This has been a scar on Philly for years. Last November, the city of Philadelphia approved a resolution formally apologizing for the, quote, the decisions leading to the devastation of May 13, 1985, and acknowledging the, quote, fundamental injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of the MOVE bombing. And in just the last few weeks, the University of Pennsylvania and Princeton University issued their own apologies after a revelation that anthropologists there had held the remains of some of the people killed in the bombing in a cardboard box for years and using them for forensic study and in an online college course. Back in 2015, Gene Demby, a native Philadelphian and co-host of the excellent NPR podcast Code Switch, reported on the 30th anniversary of the bombing. At the time, he was surprised to learn how few people had actually heard of it, and I am so pleased that Gene can join us today. Hi, Gene.
Good morning, Elton. How are you?
I'm doing great. So you were just a little guy when the MOVE bombing happened in 85. Mm-hmm. When did you realize the magnitude of what had happened?
It was always sort of a creeping realization that this was a very big deal. So if you go to any, you know, black event in Philadelphia, like any black festival, the Doom Day, things like that, you would see people with t-shirts that said, you know, remember the MOVE 9 or remember the MOVE bombing. And I would ask my mother, like, what is this? Like, what's the MOVE bombing? I don't remember it from TV. Again, I was very, 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 very young when it happened. But over time, I started to get a sense of the scope of it, you know, that this entire black West Philadelphia neighborhood had been burned to the ground by the Philadelphia police. And, you know, even as a 40-year-old man now, right, it is impossible to wrap my mind around, right? So it would have been impossible to understand as a kindergartner, right? So one of the things that's sort of fascinating and confounding about this story is that it is this catastrophe, right, this, like, gigantic story that seems to be memory hold, basically, that it sort of happened and this conflagration sort of disappears, and people don't talk about it. It's not part of, like, the sort of living history of the city.
Well, now that you are a grown man and you're a journalist and you think about your hometown, we think about our hometowns in different ways once we grow up and we leave.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing what you know about Philly, does it not make sense to you that this happened, but do you understand why this happened? Or could have happened?
Absolutely. I mean, when I was reporting out the story, when I was sort of just digging up, you know, the history of MOVE and the bombing, I talked to my mother quite a bit about just our own relationship with the Philadelphia Police Department. And we started talking about, you know, all the experiences that she had that informed the way she raised me, right? When I was growing up, she would get, you know, she would be shook if I was out too late, you know, not because we lived in a bad neighborhood, although we didn't live in the same neighborhood, but because she thought, you know, I might have had some kind of run-in with the police. So it turns out when she was much younger, one of her friends, Ricky, was killed. He was a bystander in a police shooting. And, you know, many of her friends had been, you know, yoked up by the police as they went about their business. And so, you know, she was raising me, this young black man, and she was terrified about, you know, what could happen to me. And it turns out that, you know, Philadelphia, you know, every city, this is what we learn on Code Switch all the time, is that every city has sort of a version of this. But in Philadelphia had a police department run by Frank Rizzo, who actively antagonized black Philadelphians and sort of, you know, took great pride in doing so. And so, you know, when I was reporting out this story, one of the, a big part of the story of the MOVE bombing and the politics of MOVE itself, part of like contextualizing that is having to wrestle with a police department that had been given basically carte blanche to antagonize black people, because you just don't show up on a residential block, you know, with 500 police officers and armed to the teeth and, you know, a state police helicopter with a bomb on it out of nowhere, right? That's sort of a space you've carved out, right, to sort of exercise that kind of force, right? A conceptual space to exercise that kind of force against civilians. And the Philadelphia Police Department had been doing that to black residents for a long time. Not as extreme as an example of the MOVE bombing, but had been sort of carving out the conceptual space to antagonize black people for a long time.
When you even describe it, it's ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? You're like, you said, you know, 500 and a police helicopter. When you went back to visit the block in 2015, what did you see? What did people tell you? What did they want to talk about? What didn't they want to talk about?
Yeah, so one of the first things that jumped out to me was that everyone referred to the event, you know, and by the full date. They always said May 13th, 1985. They didn't say the MOVE bombing. They said May 13th, 1985, which sort of underscored to me that for them, for them personally, if not for the city, it was a kind of cataclysm, right? It was this sort of, there was a before and an after from that event. A lot of the residents who lived on that block, 62nd and Osage and the surrounding blocks, were people who were there when the MOVE bombing happened. There was this gentleman named Gerald Renfro, who is still there today, but was there, was one of the people who was trying to get MOVE to sort of cooperate and be good neighbors and eventually try to get them evicted. He and his wife had lived there. His parents had lived there. So several generations of the Renfrews had lived on that block. And he was, you know, engaged in this protracted battle with the city to make that block whole again. So after the bombing, you know, the entire east side of the block was ostensibly rebuilt, right? Rebuilt with new homes. That the city paid for. But those homes, it turned out, were not up to code. And so for decades, they were just abandoned. They were condemned. And so, you know, when I met him in 2015, we're talking 30 years out, the damage of the block was still really visible. The damage on the block was still incredibly visible, right? There were these vacant homes that took up half the block that were unlivable, and all the stuff that comes with having vacancy on your block, right? You have people squat, you have vermin. And so, you know, Renfro and some of the other people on the block were trying to push the city to, you know, make them whole 3 decades later, still trying to get the city to do right by them, because they were, you know, the bystanders in this conflict between MOVE and the Philadelphia Police Department.
My guest is Gene Demby, co-host of NPR's Code Switch. We're talking about the MOVE bombing. The anniversary is today. Did you get a sense of what made MOVE seem so threatening at the time?
I mean, one of the most fascinating things about this story is that MOVE sort of resists categorization, right? Like, they were a black liberation group, which, you know, for a lot of us might evoke images of like the Black Panthers, but their beliefs were like much harder to sort of pin down, right? They were radical vegetarians. They used to protest at the Philadelphia Zoo all the time. They were anti-technology. They were raw foodists. At various times, they had white members. So, you know, even though they were like a black separatist group, it was sort of hard to figure out like what exactly the sort of parameters of that was. And MOVE, when they moved to 62nd and Osage, they, you know, part of their plan was to force these middle-class black residents who shared that block with them to lean on the city and the state to release 9 members of MOVE that had been arrested by the city. It was a very, like, sort of convoluted plan. And the way they wanted to do that was to antagonize their neighbors, right? They wanted to make as much noise as possible. And, you know, it sounds like a noise dispute until you think about the fact that, you know, they were armed, right? They were walking mm-hmm. around with rifles. And so, you know, the members of on the block, the people on the block often talk about the fact that, like, they didn't like move, but they also did not want them to be, like, forcibly removed in the way that the city went about it, obviously. And move sort of occupied this very weird space in Black radical politics in Philadelphia more broadly, right? Like, one Philadelphia Daily News reporter I spoke to said that they, like, very vocally broke up a meeting that had been brokered, that was meant to broker a truce between two street gangs in Philadelphia. It was mediated by some Black radical organizations, and MOVE came in and sort of blew up the meeting. They sort of just always riled people up. They sort of, I don't want to say trolling because that's, like, a little too cute, but they sort of actively antagonized everyone of every ideological stripe. And so they didn't have a lot of bedfellows. But what had Black radicals in Philadelphia, people who are Black organizers in Philadelphia, felt that, you know, the way that the police department antagonized MOVE was dangerous to every Black radical organization, mm-hmm. right? But sooner or later, the police would turn their attention on them. And so, you know, they were in cause with MOVE in opposition to the Philadelphia Police Department, even if they were not sort of ideological kindred spirits.
The Philadelphia City Council passed a resolution last November formally apologizing for the bombing and establishing today a day of observation, reflection, and recommitment, establishing today as that day. Of course, that was November 2020. First of all, what did you think when you heard that? And do you think that would have happened had it not been after George Floyd and then the summer and people taking a good look at themselves?
Oh, my God. I mean, you could ask that about so many things right now, right? I mean, true. Philadelphia has had, you know, there have been attempts to memorialize what happened in the city, right? Some, you know, very small scale attempts. A middle school tried to create a marker, and there was a big debate and fight over where that marker should go, whether it should be on city property or elsewhere. You know, when I first heard the news that happened, I mean, I guess one of the things is, like, okay, that's great, but does that, where's the sort of reparative part of it, right? Like, there's an apology here, but, you know, a whole bunch of people were destroyed, literally destroyed. A whole mm-hmm. bunch of people had their lives sort of, you know, the bombing left 250 people homeless, right? It sort of created this weird little mini diaspora of Cops Creek, Philadelphia, of Black Cops Creek, Philadelphia. People had to move away. Like, there's no reckoning with any of that. None of the people involved in the decision-making process that led to this conflagration, this, like, you know, this obliteration of this neighborhood, all those people got to have political careers, right? They got to go on and live the rest of their lives. There were no consequences for Wilson Good, who was the mayor, the first Black mayor of Philadelphia. There were no consequences for Gregory Sanborn, who was the Philadelphia police commissioner, who ordered them to let the fire burn. You know, a lot of the officials in the Good administration who were directly involved in the decision-making process went on to have long political careers. So it's not, you know, the apology is great, but, you know, what do we do with, you know, how do you make people whole? Where's the reparative part of the equation?
My guest has been Gene Demby, co-host of the NPR podcast Code Switch. Gene, thank you for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you so much, Allison.